Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Fritz Gans, representing appellant Robert Freeland. This appeal involves an insurance coverage dispute between appellant Robert Freeland and appellee U.S. Fire Insurance Company. The issues arise from the trial court's entry of summary judgment in this matter. The trial court entered summary judgment disposing of Mr. Freeland's claims for declaratory judgment, bad faith, and breach of contract arising from U.S. Fire's denial of coverage under two insurance policies issued by U.S. Fire to Burnett Construction Company. Burnett Construction Company was a contractor to Summitville Consolidated Mining Company, referred to as SCMCI. Now, Mr. Freeland was an officer and director of SCMCI from the period of, including the period of 1984 to 1986. Mr. Freeland was the sole defendant in an action brought by the United States Environmental Protection Agency and the state of Colorado relating to environmental cleanup claims under the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, CERCLA, and that action was brought in 1996. That action was settled by Mr. Freeland for a sum of $20 million. By contract, Burnett was required to indemnify and hold harmless SCMCI and its officers and directors. Also by contract, Burnett was required to procure insurance, both general liability and contractual liability insurance, for the benefit of SCMCI and its officers and directors, including Mr. Freeland. SCMCI is a named insured, and as an officer and director, Mr. Freeland is an insured, additional insured under those policies issued by U.S. Fire. Now, Burnett met its obligations again by procuring the two policies U.S. Fire issued for the periods 1984 through 1986. Mr. Freeland sued Burnett at the time doing business as TAWB in April of 2003, and it was at that time, as part of that litigation, that Mr. Freeland became aware of the insurance policies that U.S. Fire had issued to Burnett. Burnett paid a nominal sum to settle that litigation and assigned its rights against U.S. Fire to Mr. Freeland. This action was brought for direct coverage from U.S. Fire by Mr. Freeland, his standing as an insured, additional insured, or a third-party beneficiary to the U.S. Fire policies. The trial court granted summary judgment September 12, 2007, and this entry of judgment was an error for several reasons. First, a jury could reasonably conclude that Mr. Freeland is an additional insured under the U.S. Fire policies. In addition, there's no clear, unequivocal exclusion of Mr. Freeland from the covered from the coverage provided under the U.S. Fire policies, such that summary judgment was inappropriate and should be reversed. Third, when all possible inferences are drawn in favor of Mr. Freeland, as they should on summary judgment as the non-moving party, a jury could certainly conclude he was not only an additional insured under the policies, but an intended third-party beneficiary. Finally, there is sufficient evidence of one of the issues was the 1986 policy has been lost and or destroyed. There is sufficient evidence of the existence of that policy, including a certificate of insurance, and its loss or destruction stems from the inability of Mr. Freeland to produce that policy. It's not in his possession or power to produce. And the trial court's entry of summary judgment precluding any of his claims under that policy for lack of evidence of the policy should be reversed as well.
Counsel, could we go backwards and start with the 1986 before we get to the 1985 policy?
Certainly.
What proof do you have in the record that the lost document statute was complied with in this case?
With respect to the lost document statute, Mr. Freeland needs to come forward with evidence that the policy did at one time exist. In this case, there is the certificate of insurance that has the U.S. Fire policy number on it. In addition, U.S. Fire's own copy of the 1985 policy has handwritten notations on it that indicate an R indicating that the policy was replaced and has the same policy number.
Is he required to have personal knowledge and be able to attest to that?
It's not clear that he needs to have personal knowledge to simply come forward with sufficient evidence that the policy did exist.
Mr. Gans, let me follow up on Judge Roman's question. Part of the language in 1325.113, the lost documents statute, says that somebody who's trying to introduce a lost document shall not be permitted to give evidence of the contents thereof by a competent witness unless said party or his agent or attorney first makes an oath to the loss or destruction thereof. So I'm not sure how that was done, if it was done in this case.
In this case, the affidavit of Mr. Mueller, who's an attorney of our firm. And to put a little context on these particular documents, Mr. Friedland did not ever at any time have in his possession a copy of the 1986 policy. The documents, any documents that we have related to the U.S. Fire policies were either obtained from Burnett or from U.S. Fire in this case. All documents related to the Somerville mine site, and at least since the inception of the 1996 litigation from by EPA, have been in the possession and control of Mr. Friedland's attorneys. The evidence of the existence of that policy include not only the certificate of insurance, but also the handwritten notations on U.S. Fire's copy of the policy. In addition, U.S. Fire's own expert, Mr. Quigley, has testified that that policy was in fact issued, and neither party in this action has been able to produce a copy of that policy.
Does the statute also require that there be an oath as to the substance or contents of that policy?
That's not our reading of the statute, Your Honor. The evidence, once the policy has been determined to have existed, and no one can come forward and in fact produce a copy of that policy, its contents can be proven both by the contents of the policy that it was a renewal of, the 1985 policy, or by specimen policies from other standard industry forms. So with that respect, the trial court's order precluding any secondary evidence of the contents of the 1996 policy should be reversed, in that it has been established that the policy did exist. The terms can be proven by secondary evidence, including the 1985 contract, insurance contract, as well as specimen policies within the industry.
I noticed you cited to a 10th Circuit case, but that 10th Circuit case was relying on Kansas law. Isn't that right?
That's correct. With respect to the 1985 policy, Mr. Friedland is an additional insured. Burnett was a contractor to SCMCI. It's undisputed that they were required by contract to obtain general and contractual liability insurance. Mr. Friedland was an officer and director of SCMCI for the relevant time period covered by these insurance contracts. And in fact, as indicated by the subsequent construction contracts, those contracts did amend the original contract to make it very clear that officers and directors of FCMCI were to benefit from the insurance that Burnett was required to procure.
Can you state what provision is the direct benefit to a director or officer?
I'm sorry, within the 1985 contract?
Mm-hmm.
There are both the agreements that Burnett indemnify SCMCI and its officers. That is an express agreement that SCMCI and its officers would benefit from Burnett, both in terms of indemnification, and then there's an obligation in that 1985 contract to procure insurance as well. Now, there is obviously an issue of fact as to whether or not that 1985 contract would have extended the benefit of the insurance that Burnett was required to procure to the officers and directors, and the subsequent contracts, both the 1986 and the 1987 construction contracts, would be evidence that indeed that was the agreement and the intent of the parties at the time of contract.
At the time of the 1985 contract?
Yes. Again, the indemnification provision makes clear that Burnett did hold both an indemnification obligation to SCMCI and its officers, and the omission of its officers and directors in reference to the obligation to procure insurance can be resolved and reconciled with the 1986 and 1987 contracts that go back to make it very clear that that was the intent. There's no other reason to go back. And again, it's an issue of fact, and here we're on summary judgment. Certainly something that a jury could reasonably conclude from both the 1986 and 1987 contracts that the 1985 contract also, in spite of the fact that there is not an express statement of its intent to cover, to extend the benefit of insurance to the officers and directors of MCI, SCMCI, it is in fact a reasonable inference that a jury could draw. And that is particularly why summary judgment was inappropriate on that contract interpretation. And we should go back. The trial court never found either the 1985 insurance policy or the 1985 construction contract is unambiguous. For the 1985 insurance policy to be unambiguous, they'd also have to find that the construction contract was unambiguous in terms of its who was to benefit from this insurance and whether or not Mr. Friedland was an intended additional insured. These are clearly issues that should have been resolved at trial on the merits of these claims. This type of fact-intensive inquiry does not lend itself to summary judgment, the trial court, obviously, for that reason, should be reversed. It improperly narrowed the plain meaning of both the 1985 construction contract and the 1985 U.S. fire policy.
Mr. Ganz, I'm not sure I'm following you as to your argument that this is a question of fact. Isn't it a question of law as to the interpretation of the 85 policy, unless it's ambiguous?
Yes, Your Honor.
I haven't heard you say that it's ambiguous.
Your Honor, they certainly are ambiguous. There's been no finding that they were unambiguous, and the trial court in its analysis, in fact, assessed secondary evidence as to the meaning of these contracts, specifically with respect to contractual liability insurance. Where there's an indemnification clause in the underlying contract, that raises a question of fact as to whether or not construction liability insurance should cover the indemnities as additional insurers. The trial court did indicate that they reviewed evidence relating to the facts and circumstances surrounding the procurement of the insurance policies. But in fact, there was no discussion of what evidence was reviewed, but that is a necessary step in the inquiry. It necessarily involves resolving questions of fact, and those facts are not undisputed here. At this time, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Ganz.
I guess that's as far as it goes. Good afternoon. I'm Catherine Eubank, and I represent United States Fire Insurance Company in this matter. And I guess I'd like to start off by urging the court to keep separate the different components that make up this case. The 1985 Burnett construction contract is not the same thing as the 1985 insurance policy. We do have both of those documents, however, so I do believe it is a matter for this court, as a matter of law, to construe those documents to determine whether or not Mr. Friedland is an additional insured under the insurance policy. In addition, the 1986 construction contract is an alleged contract. We have an unsigned document that was presented with Mr. Friedland's response to the motion for summary judgment without any affidavit or any other admissible evidence regarding the authenticity, the origin, whether or not it was actually signed or agreed to by Burnett. We have no evidence on the record to confirm that that agreement was actually entered into. It's just a written document that's unsigned. The 1986 insurance policy, we have very little evidence of. We have the certificate of insurance that Mr. Friedland, again, added to his response to the motion for summary judgment without any evidence regarding authenticity, et cetera. And at that point in time, U.S. Fire had received no evidence that that policy had actually been issued. It searched its own records, its own, I guess, compartments or compiled insurance policy records, couldn't find a record that that policy had ever been issued. And it was only after the summary judgments had all been thoroughly briefed and we were getting ready for trial that it was discovered that there was an absolute pollution exclusion endorsement with the same policy number as the alleged 1986 insurance policy. And that was discovered by our expert as he was getting ready to disclose opinions. He was going to disclose the opinion that the certificate of insurance was not enough to show that a policy had actually been issued by United States Fire Insurance. That certificate of insurance apparently having been issued by Mr. Friedland's insurance agent and not by United States Fire Insurance.
Ms. Eubank,
yes.
Let me ask you about Mr. Friedland's position in his briefs that your expert, Mr. Quigley, agreed that there was or concluded that there was a 1986 policy.
Well,
what is your comment about that?
Yes, and that is what I was just about to explain, is his first assessment was that it was likely that, more likely than not, that a policy had not ever been issued. Otherwise, U.S. Fire would have been able to locate that policy or some record of having issued it at some point. However, once that absolute pollution exclusion endorsement was located, he said, yes, I remember we added this endorsement to the 1986 policies that were issued. And he remembers he was part of the underwriting team that developed that pollution exclusion endorsement. And he said if there had been a 1986 policy issued, it would have contained this endorsement. And the fact that there is a signed endorsement means that it looks like it was issued. It may have been canceled right after that. We don't know. That would explain why it still hasn't been found by United States Fire in its policy records. But it looks like it was issued, but it was issued with this endorsement. And this endorsement excludes coverage of the CERCLA damages that are alleged.
Well, I understand that from the briefs, but the first question that we're considering with regard to the, whether there was a 1986 policy was whether the 1986 policy existed. And then the second question, which you're addressing, is if it existed, there was no coverage under the absolute pollution exclusion clause. But with regard to the first question, does Mr. Quigley's statement get us far enough along under the lost document statute to say, yes, there was a 1986 policy?
I believe that he would, yes, is the short answer to your question. I believe that Mr. Quigley would testify in his belief that it's more likely than not that the policy was issued since there is a signed endorsement. However, he can't testify necessarily to the entire contents of what that policy was. The only thing he can be sure of is that it had that endorsement in it.
So he would testify to that, and that's actually consistent with the Epperson case talking about a presumption that a policy is the same as the policy that was issued in the prior year.
I believe that he would be able to testify that there were minor changes to the policy form between 1985 and 1986, but he would be the one person who would be able to talk about what a policy would look like if it had been issued, having been the head of the underwriting department for United States Fire at that time.
So then if I understand your position correctly, it's what you're saying now is that there may well have been enough evidence to show that there was a 1986 policy, but if there was no coverage because of the absolute pollution exclusion clause.
Well, that would be one of the reasons why there's no coverage, and,
okay.
And a clear and obvious one. There are a number of arguments, and we presented a number of arguments to the trial court, and so whichever arguments the panel is interested in, I'm happy to address. I would like to address one thing that was asserted in the beginning of argument for Mr. Friedland, And that is the issue as to whether or not the 1986 and 1987 construction contracts should be looked at to determine the intent of the 1985 construction contract. My belief is that that 1985 construction contract is plain and unambiguous on its face. There's no need to look to parole evidence or extrinsic evidence to interpret that. And under the 1985 contract, it's very clear that Summitville Inc. And its officers and directors were to be indemnified by Burnett, but that indemnity provision is in a completely separate part of the contract from the insurance provisions. And it's equally clear, in my mind, that the insurance provision only requires only required Burnett to provide insurance for Summitville Inc. and specified interested parties. And Mr. Friedland is not included in that definition of interested parties. So I would argue that there's no indication under the plain and unambiguous terms of the contract itself that the parties intended that Burnett be required to procure insurance for Mr. Friedland or that he be an additional insured under the United States fire policy.
Now, Mr. Gantz had cited in the brief the Marlin case stating that if there is a provision for indemnity that would provide for insurance coverage.
I believe the Marlin case is actually distinguishable on several points. In that case, my recollection of that case is that the contract language specifically required both that the interested party be an indemnity and an additional insured. So the contract in that case had different language. It required insurance coverage as well as indemnification of the party seeking coverage. We don't have that in this case. And also, it's decided under West Virginia law, which is different than Colorado law. West Virginia law, according to the Marlin case, allows direct claims to be asserted against an insurance carrier by the claimant who's asserting claims against the named insured. And in this case, Mr. Friedland is not asserting a claim against U.S. Fire as a claimant. He's asserting it as an alleged additional insured. Getting to the alternative arguments, just to make sure that if there are any questions the panel has regarding the alternative arguments, as to the 1985 policy, Colorado law does not allow third-party beneficiary status under an insurance policy unless it's direct evidence that the person was intended to be an additional insured. There are means of making sure that someone is insured under an insurance policy. That's part of the insurance industry. You can have endorsements that specifically name an additional insured, or you can have this underlying contract that specifically says that the named insured is required to procure insurance for somebody. In that case, then that person might be an additional insured. That's not the case in the facts that we have here. There is no evidence that the parties intended Mr. Friedland to be a direct beneficiary of the insurance policy itself. In addition to the arguments that we've already discussed, I believe it's important to note that U.S. Fire was an umbrella or excess carrier, and the Maryland policy underneath was never exhausted, so there was never a duty to defend. So U.S. Fire never had a duty to defend Mr. Friedland with regard to the EPA lawsuit.
Let me ask you a question about the 1985 contract. Did it require that Burnett provide umbrella insurance as well as primary insurance?
The 1985 contract, my recollection is that it required $2 million worth of coverage, which could be either a primary policy or it could be combined with excess to get to the $2 million level. Another point that's significant with regard to the 1986 contract is the one that we make in our cross appeal, which is that there having never been any proper presentation of evidence to verify the existence of that contract, it shouldn't be considered at all. And that takes away any questions regarding the alleged 1986 policy, whether it was issued or whether it was not, the application of the pollution exclusion. If there's no verified insurance, or I'm sorry, construction contract to create an additional insured issue, then there is no issue with regard to coverage under the 1986 policy. Another argument that's important to note is the legal presumption of prejudice, because there was no notice given to U.S. Fire regarding the EPA lawsuit until several years after Mr. Friedland had already settled that suit. The prior Friedland versus Travelers case, the court noted that there's a presumption of prejudice that the carrier does not have any coverage unless the alleged insured can rebut that presumption. Mr. Friedland has made no attempt in any of the briefing in the trial court or in the appellate briefing to rebut that presumption of prejudice. And the other argument that applies to both of the policies would be the one-year statute of limitations. It's clear in the 1985 policy that exists. There's a one-year statute of limitations for an insured to make a claim against the carrier for amounts that it has paid in settlement. And the EPA settlement occurred in December 2000. There was no notice given to U.S. Fire until much later, and obviously no claim against the U.S. Fire policy until much later. Unless the panel has any further questions, I'd like to stand on the briefs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eubank.
Just a couple of points on rebuttal, Your Honors. There is indeed evidence in the record of the party's intent, and it's Mr. Pettigrew of Burnett Construction testified that indeed he procured the U.S. Fire policies to cover all of his liabilities and obligations under the construction contracts, including the 1985 contract. Certainly, that is evidence that at a minimum, Mr. Friedland would be an intended third-party beneficiary under those policies. And with respect to the underlying insurance and whether or not the U.S. Fire policies would have a duty to defend, certainly if the policies are found not to drop down as umbrella coverage can in the absence of underlying insurance coverage, they certainly would be triggered at amounts at the attachment points and above. That is, if you reach the attachment point, the lower threshold to trigger the umbrella policies, that would obviously trigger the coverage in full. With respect to the obligation to rebut a presumption of prejudice for late notice, that's not an issue that was briefed on the motion for summary judgment. Certainly, that's an issue of fact that Mr. Friedland has the opportunity to come forward and offer evidence to rebut a presumption of prejudice for late notice. With respect to the lost document and the existence of the 1986 policy, the trial court indeed agreed that the lost document statute had been satisfied, albeit in an order granting our motion to amend the summary judgment order that came two days too late under the 60-day period. So with that, we will rest on the briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Gantz. Thank you again, Ms. Eubank. We appreciate your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Once counsel has had an opportunity to gather their